Hey friends, it's Eric Sorensen, co-host of 30 Minutes in the New Testament, here with a special announcement. And that announcement is that 30 Minutes in the New Testament can now be found on YouTube. If you click on the link in the show notes here just below me, you're going to see that we have our own YouTube page. And the reason we're doing that is because from now on, we're going to be recording not just audio of the episodes, which will continue on the various podcast platforms that you use, but we're also going to film our episodes so that you can access video. And so make sure to click on that link, subscribe today so you can keep up with all the clips we release and all our future episodes. Thanks so much.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there and everything else that is sitting there on the website for your consumption. Lots of other podcasts, articles, videos, academy courses, events. We got it all, doing it all, and you should go and check that stuff out. If you're just one of those people that, like, you know, you found the podcast, you subscribe to the podcast, but you've never typed in 1517.org into your browser. Oh man, you this is the tip of the iceberg, guys. I mean, you got to get over there and avail yourself of all of the richness, all of the other goodies that are going on. So do that if you've not done it before. And of course, while you're at the website, you could make your way over to the right-hand corner, hit that donate button, and you could support everything that we do. Because of course, it is all possible because of listeners, readers, watchers, people like you. And if you're one of those people, we thank you very much for helping us continue to do it. All right, Chad, last episode, you know, we talked a lot about wisdom. We had a little break, got to talk about wisdom. Great chapter, chapter 28 of Job. We did finish that and moved into 29, which is sort of feels like 29 really should have followed 27. Job, you know, he's given some rebuttals in 27. And then you have this break in 28, but then in 29, Job is starting to get a little nostalgic. He's looking back and saying, man, how the mighty have fallen. Let me tell you, I mean, there was a day not that long ago where I felt like God was really for me, that God was blessing me, and I was even trying to do the right thing with those blessings. I mean, I was prosperous, and I had all these children, and God had given me all these gifts, and in that blessing, I was able to be a help to other people, and man, everything was just good. I've just felt the favor of God, and I was trying to be a good neighbor to other people, and that was, man, I'll tell you what, those days were better days, and who can argue with Job on this point?
Yeah, definitely no argument there. Considering where he's at now, which, of course, what he's going to talk about in the next chapter, things were a night and day difference. I like the way we wrapped up last time. Verse 13 says that, this is Job speaking, he says, I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. So, I mean, that summation will tell you everything about Job. I mean, you take someone who, or we ordinarily associate with grief, because of course she's a widow. We think about her being brokenhearted. Well, Job comes along and causes that heart to sing for joy. Why? Well, because he is her advocate. He's her protector. He's doing everything he can within his means and within his influence to do good for people, as we'll hear more in just a verse or two, who either physically or emotionally or financially can't do for themselves. So he really is doing a lot of good for a whole lot of people, not just his wealthy cronies, but people who are people who are unable to do for themselves. So
yeah, and you're going to see a lot more of that. I mean, he has this break. So he says that about the widow's heart, and then in verse 14, he just sort of like makes this statement before kind of moving back into this list of things that he was able to do, and he says, "Hey, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban." Like, so he has this idea that he was like clothed in righteousness, right? So he had all this righteousness, and what did he do after that? Well, then he goes and starts listing more things that he was able to do, in this righteousness, right?
Yeah, and I mean that's I just pulled up on my little Logo search engine here, this idea of righteousness and clothing, man, that's all over the scriptures.
Oh yeah.
You know, you got Isaiah talking about righteousness being the belt of his waist, and then you've got the breastplate of righteousness in the famous, you know, armor section of Ephesians chapter 6. You've got Isaiah talking about putting on righteousness as a breastplate. I mean, it's all over the place. It's the idea that this is what's wrapped around you. And that becomes this clothing. It's kind of like a uniform. You know, when you see someone in a uniform, there are certain expectations you have of that person. Well, you put on righteousness as a uniform. Well, that's going to be displayed in certain sorts of ways as well. So this becomes the uniform that he wears that's been given him by God, by which he is going to do all these great things for the needy.
Well, I think too, it's important. Like, you could read this and be like, kind of bragging a little bit here, Job. I mean, just flaunting all your good works. That would be the wrong way to read this, I think. I think instead what he's doing is saying, like, he enjoyed the days. Of course, there are better days. He's not, all his children weren't dead, and he wasn't sitting on an ash heap covered in boils. I mean, that's an obvious reason to like those days better. But also that he felt like he was doing good to people, and that was he felt good about that, right? So he had a lot of meaning and purpose and was able to help other people. And this is more of him sort of recounting these things, which really is a contrast to some of the accusations that were brought against him that were just like completely fabricated, right? Like this is the opposite of what he was accused of. And then also, as he's sort of trying to figure out how this went wrong, and he's thinking back, he's like, man, I was doing this, I was doing that. Karmically, this doesn't make any sense. Like right. I didn't deserve this.
Yeah, yeah. I do think a big part of this is, well, ordinarily, it's not great if you have to defend yourself. Ordinarily, mm-hmm. your friends are the ones who do that. Well, right. There are no friends here who are stepping up and saying, hey, you guys, just hold off a minute. I know Job. Let me tell you what Job has done in the past. Instead, the friends are the accusers. So it's up to Job to be like, listen, guys, all of these accusations which you've leveled against me are not only false, but they're completely contrary to what is publicly known about me. This is what I did. This is who I was. So, yeah, it's not bragging. It's simply stating the facts in the face of the false accusations that are labeled against him. And he goes on to say, verse 15, how... I love this verse because it, I don't know, there's something about it that's even different. He says, I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. You know, in a lot of societies, ancient societies, man, if you were in any way physically disabled because you were blind or because you were lame or because you were whatever, you were in a terrible position unless you had family or close friends who were going to take care of you.
Yeah.
Well, here's Job stepping up. Oh, that blind person over there. I'm going to be eyes to that blind person. I'm going to lead them where they need to go. And that lame person over there, I'm going to carry him. I'm going to carry her. I'm going to be feet to the one who's lame. So in some ways, verse 15 strikes me as the most powerful of these arguments that Job is putting forth. Even those who tend to be overlooked by ancient societies, reduced to beggary. Well, Job is taking care of them.
Yeah, because this isn't the same as today. Like, someone might be like, man, there was this guy, he was blind, and so I helped him, you know, get where he was going. And you're like, well, you'd have to be an epically bad person not to do that. Like, what in the world? Like, who's going to not do that? Like, that'd be crazy. Because yeah. Our society would tell you that you were like uniquely wicked if you didn't do such a thing, right? This was not the case in the ancient world. Like, I mean, if you were blind, you can take the arguments of Job's friends about like, well, Job, if you're covered in boils, what'd you do? And just apply that to how the general society would have looked at a guy that was blind and be like, well, I don't know, man, what'd you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the Gospel of John, right?
Yep.
Not the Pharisees, but Jesus' own disciples said, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents? He was born blind.
Yep.
I would just, that was the assumption. So it's kind of a, oh, well, yeah, I guess you're getting what you deserve kind of approach to these physical limitations.
That would have been epic if Jesus would have been like, I mean, not that Jesus' response wasn't good. Of course, it was very good. But maybe, you know, it just wasn't written down, and maybe he was, maybe rolled off with a, who sinned, Job or his parents, that he was sitting on that trash heap?
Yeah, that would have been a good, that would have been a good response. So he goes on in 16, I was a father to the needy, and I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know.
Now, I think that's a really powerful line, too, that he's saying, like, look, it wasn't like I stumbled across a blind guy and helped him, and stumbled across a lame guy and helped him, and stumbled across a widow and helped her out. No. I was, like, seeking out the causes of people. Like, imagine Job going up. He's doing so well. He's going up to people and be like, do you know anyone in need? Are there any causes out there that I'm unaware of? Do you have a cousin? Do you have a friend? Do you have a neighbor? Because I have been so blessed that I want to aid in the causes of people, whether I know them or not. That's now you're talking about like a whole different kind of good work, right? Where you're just like trying to find them.
Yeah, I was going to say he is actively searching out how he can do good. So, yeah, above and beyond what we would ordinarily expect of someone. He was also, okay, we might be thinking, well, that's a lot of positive things to do, but did you defend anybody? If you saw somebody being taken advantage of, did you step in and stop that? And verse 17 speaks to that. Under the image of kind of predators, he says, I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. It's pretty gripping image there. So you've seen either in real life or in videos, you've seen, either a lion or a wolf or whatever it might be, grab the prey, whatever it is, and running along with this animal hanging from their mouth. That's the image here. Job says, I stepped in and I grabbed that predator and I broke the fangs of that predator and made him drop his prey from his teeth. In other words, I went in when there were people acting like beasts and abusing others, and I put a stop to it. I made sure that they could no longer destroy, abuse, take advantage of whatever it is they were doing. Job stepped in, risk whatever he had to risk in order to put an end to this evil. And as a result of this, verse 18 says, I thought, on the basis of all these things, Job says, I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My roots shall spread out to the waters with the dew all night on my branches, my glory fresh with me, and my bow ever new in my hand. Yeah, if you ever want to talk about how the Bible deals with mixed metaphors, well, there's one. He's got nest images in here. He's got tree images in here. He's got bow and arrow images in here. This is a typical biblical metaphor where they not only do not hesitate to mix metaphors, but actively do mix metaphors. So, yeah, basically what Job is saying is, I thought I'm going to die an old man full of days. Everything's going to be great. To be in my nest, roots are spread out, got everything that I need, my bow is going to be ever new in my hand, and that's the way it's going to end. Of course,
do you think this is like curious of your interpretation of this, do you think this is a little bit of Job saying, or an admission even that, I used to think a little more like you guys, maybe not completely, but mm-hmm. It's like, hey, yeah. I had all this blessing, I was doing all this stuff, and thought that equals this, like this. So this is what's going to happen to me. That's what I thought too. Turns out, no.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's the way that Job thought. I mean, I think that's typically what happens to us until our life falls apart. If you're a man like Job, blameless in his generation, doing all this good, and you're also very influential, you're very wealthy, you got all your children, people look up to you, then it's quite natural to kind of be lulled into a theological conclusion that as a result of all this good that I'm doing, all of this good is being enjoyed by me.
Yeah.
Until, you know, somebody comes along and drops a nuclear bomb into your entire way of life. And then it causes you to stop and to reassess your theology. I don't know. I mean, it's conjecture, but I suspect that was the case with Job as well.
But just kind of, I mean, you can kind of, you're reading into it a little bit when he's saying that. But it's, and by the way, that in no way implies that that's the reason he's doing it, but that Job assumed that his being the kind of person he was would result in certain things. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that's the motivation for it, but he does seem to think like that's kind of what I thought. I thought that, I mean, why would God have why would God be against me? Like I'm
yeah.
doing his work. I'm enjoying it. Like this is the life I live. And it seems that he's saying, yeah, that I had that assumption too, guys, but no.
But no. And I mean, as we pointed out multiple times, scripture does make promises along those lines. Mm-hmm. You know, God does reward people for the good that they do. And yeah, we're not trying to dismantle that. We're just simply saying that is not an ironclad promise that happens every single time. No more than it's an ironclad threat that, hey, if you sin, if you go out and you break God's law, then he's going to come down hard on you. Well, we've seen many situations in the scripture where the wicked prosper.
Yeah.
So those general truths have plenty of exceptions to them. Well, let's wrap up. We got 21 through 25, wrap up this chapter. This is the conclusion of Job's reminiscing of the better days. He says, men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as for the spring rain. I smiled on them when they had no confidence, and the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose their way and sat as chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. So this is, of course, continuation of that, although I think with a slightly different focus. This is more talking about the esteem in which Job was held for good reason. You know, he uses the image of a king among his troops, and it's the idea, you know, everybody's kind of talking, everyone's, you know, like we do. There's an issue or a question, and a bunch of us are sitting around talking about it, and I give my opinion, you give your opinion, and we're all just kind of, you know, stating what we think about something. And then along comes somebody that everybody looks up to, and he speaks, and then after that, everybody's kind of like, well, I guess that's the answer.
Yeah.
That's when Job speaks, everybody's like, oh, okay, that's the right answer. End of discussion. So that's
you ever been in one of those situations where, like, you know, this happens in theology a lot, right? And maybe you were even like on a panel or something, or maybe just in a group of people, and someone asks a question, and you know, someone answers the question, and then, you know, you answer the question, and then another guy answers the question, and then this last guy, he answers the question, and you're like, that was the answer right there. You know, if you had started there,
we all could have shut up. Yeah, unfortunately, I've been in those situations a number of times.
Yeah.
not as the final speaker either, you know, yeah. One of the initial speakers.
Yeah.
You want to come back and say, I'm going to
change my answer. I'm going to strike it from the record, what he said.
Yeah, my response is now what he said. Yeah, well, it's kind of a what Job said situation. And he ends this by going back in a way to the earlier theme. He says, I was like one who comforts mourners, which is probably a partial jab at his friends who are miserable comforters, of course. And keep in mind, too, that Job isn't just simply stricken with pain and suffering because he's lost his health or because he's lost his possessions. This guy has lost all of his kids, not right. one, not two or three, every single one of them. So grief and mourning are haunting his every step as well. And Job says, I used to be like, I was sitting in your shoes Bildad, Zophar, Eliphaz, I was sitting in your shoes, and yet I was the comforter of mourners, not the accuser of mourners.
Yep.
So that's chapter 29. That is a rehearsal by Job of all the good things in which he was engaged as he was clothed in righteousness and acted lovingly, mercifully, wisely as a leader of his people back in the good old days before everything struck. So no surprise, when we get to chapter 30, things are going to be quite different. In fact,
this is like an exact, like this chapter break, I mean, it's fine, you got to break them up, but like you wouldn't want to close the book, you know, wait a week, come back, and start with, but, the word, but, you're like, but what? You're like, okay, so all these guys that were like, oh man, they were seeking out my counsel, and like, man, they spoke about me in hushed and reverent tones. And, but now, yeah, now they laugh at me.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, three times in this chapter, we're going to have the same Hebrew word, but now, ba'ata. It's going to be in this first verse, verse 9 and verse 16. And they're all three, even though I think ESV has but now, they're all three contrastive. This is the way the situation was before, chapter 29. But now, here is the situation in chapter 30. And he's going to start out here in, I don't know, for me, kind of an unexpected way. He's going to spend, I think, the first 8 verses in chapter 30 painting this picture of the most, kind of the dregs of society, like the people that are living more like animals than they are human beings. And his whole point is going to be these people are actually mocking me and laughing at me now. So I'll read through these first 8 verses. You can kind of get a taste for this entire picture that Job is painting. But now they laugh at me, men who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. What could I gain from the strength of their hands, men whose vigor is gone? Through want and hard hunger, they gnaw the dry ground by night in waste and desolation. They pick saltwort, I hope I'm saying that word right, saltwort and the leaves of bushes and the roots of the broom tree for their food. They are driven out from human company. They shout after them as after a thief. In the gullies of the torrents they must dwell, in holes of the earth and of the rocks. Among the bushes they bray, under the nettles they huddle together. A senseless, a nameless brood, they have been whipped out of the land. And this is some powerful imagery here. Now, all of that is describing, Job has gone to great lengths to depict for us through all kinds of just kind of beastly images who these people are. And his whole point is these people that really kind of seem subhuman. In fact, he even uses animal imagery, like among the bushes they bray like a donkey, and they're out there making animal noises. They're living in holes in the ground. They're rooting around among these trees, picking leaves off of bushes, gnawing the ground. These people, who are, according to Job's description, basically subhuman, they have the audacity now, given Job's position, given all his losses, to laugh at him.
Yeah, I mean, these are I guess this idea that the people that it sounds like all of society has rejected, and not because like they were blind or poor or like for some unjust reason, but like for good reasons, right? Like, so society's like, okay, these guys, they go after them like a thief and this kind of stuff. Even the people of that caliber, they laugh at my predicament.
As if it's kind of the idea that we are superior to you, and so we're going to look down upon you and mock you, Job.
Yes. Yes. Like that, this is how, like, so if you contrast it with what he was saying, the kind of person he was and the things he was doing, he's like, now what am I doing? I'm being laughed at by like the very dregs of society. Or like, oh man, well, you know what? It's like a joke at a, you're sitting around a, you're like 20 guys sitting around a fire on the outskirts of town trying to, you know, split a squirrel 20 ways. And they're like, the joke is, well, at least you're not Job.
Yeah, got it better than that guy. Have you seen him lately? Yeah, we're living the high life compared to him. Yeah, so this is some pretty deep bitterness, I think, on the part of and understandably on the part of Job, especially in contrast to what he's just described as the days when he was looked up to, and when people like this, like he said, even they're the fathers of these men, I would not have even put with the dogs in my flock. You know, I wouldn't even, certainly I wouldn't have hired them as shepherds, but I wouldn't have even put them out there with the pack of hounds that go along with my shepherds. So that's the first part of chapter 30. He's not done though. Okay. Verse 9 is going to begin a second part. He says, and now, or but now, I have become their song. I'm a byword to them. They abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me. Well, there's one of those cultural nonverbal expressions of disgust that has not changed through the millennia, right?
Right.
Yeah, if somebody spits at you, it doesn't matter if you live, 3,000 years ago or 2024. Not good. Not a mark of respect. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me because God has loosed my cord and humbled me. They have cast off restraint in my presence. On my right hand, the rabble rise. They push away my feet. They cast up against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They need no one to help them. As through a wide breach they come, amid the crash they roll on. Terrors are turned upon me. My honor is pursued as by the wind, and my prosperity has passed away like a cloud.
You do have to wonder, in light of all of this. So Job, we don't know how long he's been sitting on this trash heap with these boils, but we know it was a week. I don't know how long it was before then, but you do have to wonder. Like, you're not told this part of the story, but based on what Job says here, like, and it seems as though he's become a mockery, and not just that, like, this is happening in private, but that, like, literally people that maybe people that like hated him when he was in positions of influence and power and stuff like that, and were jealous or whatever, that he has become sort of a laughing stock to them, and they actually do, like, he's a spectacle.
I read sections like this, and there's Psalms that talk in the same way. David describes how his enemies mock him, laugh at him, taunt him. He becomes a byword to them. One of the Psalms says, "I am the song of drunkards." So the same kind of lamentation, based upon how one is treated by others. In this, mocking sort of way. That's all over the Psalms. Every time I hear this, my mind goes immediately to the crucifixion, where the same thing happened. You know, here you have just this terrible scene of atrocious brutality. You got Jesus been stripped, of course, whipped, bleeding from head to toe, publicly being executed. And what do the chief priests and others who are passing by, what do? They mock him. I mean, really, it's a window into the ugliest parts of humanity when we mock the people who are suffering the way that Job suffered and the way that Jesus suffered as
I mean,
well. I mean, it's all.
you could be like a pretty bad person, and if you were being like crucified in public, I mean, like, even if you deserved it, I don't know. I don't think I'm probably like reveling in it and like spitting at you and stuff. Like, you'd have to have done something to me like personally that was horrific, like, I would think, you know. So that, yeah, it's definitely a wild thing to think about, where you're like, of course Jesus didn't do anything to anyone. Like, you have to do more than just like say words I don't like for me to get there, you know. Like, it's pretty wild. But we see that happen all the time. I mean, you see that happen when, you know, political leaders get overthrown and that kind of stuff, and people, there is like the madness of the mob, and people lose their minds.
Yeah, it's kind of it's the scapegoat mentality, you know, that kind of goes into the mob mentality. It's this idea that this is one that we are going to heap all of our abuse and all of our shame upon as the scapegoat of our group or of our city or of our society. And yeah, it's happening to Job and happened to our Lord as well. So I don't know if there's anything else we need to say about those verses. Anything you want to add to 9 to 15? It's all pretty straightforward, especially the part about the mockery that's being heaped upon him. All right. So verse 16 is our third but now. But now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tunic. God has cast me into the mire, and I become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind, you make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. So Job, he's shifted here. He's talking directly to God at this point.
Yeah.
You know, this is I don't think he did that at all in chapter 29, at least not directly addressing God. Did not do so in the opening part of 30. But as we see frequently in Job's responses to his friends or his speeches, he'll weave back and forth from talking to his friends just to talking seemingly to some general audience. And then he'll, as it were, lift up his eyes to heaven and speak directly to God. And that's what he's doing here.
Yeah, at first you maybe think he's talking about God. You know, so he's like, yeah, well, first he starts with, you know, my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones. The pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds about me like the collar of my tunic. God has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. And you're like, okay, so who do you think did all this? He thinks God did all this. And then he says, I cry to you. Right. So now, like, this is the move, right, takes place right here. He says, God did this, and let me talk to him real quick. Mm-hmm. I have some things to say to him. And if you now, we've said many times that the Psalms give you permission to say all kinds of, you know, things that maybe some super pious people would say, you can't say that to God. And the Psalms say, yeah, you can. Well, Job does that too, because what we do know is that God does not seem to think that anything that Job says in the course of this, we will find out, was inappropriate or, you know, out of bounds. And Job makes some pretty, some pretty heavy allegations here.
Yeah, yeah. He's, as he's done elsewhere in the book, he's turning directly to God and basically saying, you have caused the situation in which I'm in. And he uses the same kind of very painful, direct language here that he uses elsewhere. And that, again, that the Psalms frequently do as well. God's, you know, thrown him about. He's become cruel to him, persecuted him. Verse 22, I get this image of being pulled up by a tornado and then thrown down to the ground at another location. He says, you lift me up on the wind. You make me ride on it. And you toss me about in the roar of the storm. This tornadic fury has picked him up, and he's swirling about, carried about by the wind, and he's tossed to and fro. And he says, I know what's going to happen. Verse 23, I know that you're going to bring me to death into the house appointed for all living.
Yeah,
which of course
that language,
you know,
that
where
language
he wants to go.
Yeah, well, that language is. It sounds like, yeah, man, I got sucked. You caused me to get sucked up in this tornado, and there I was just getting flung all about. And then what'd you do? You spit me right into a hurricane. I mean, like, there's just no relief happening anywhere. Like once I get out of this windstorm, I'm right into the middle of a hurricane. And yeah, there's no relief anywhere. And this is going to result in what? I mean, eventually, I know what's going to happen. Like, I'm going to die, but you're also dragging it out.
Yeah, I get this too in verse 24. This man, this is quite the image. He says, "Yet does not one in a heap of ruin stretch out his hand, and in his disaster cry out for help." We've all seen these pictures. You know, maybe it was a bombing, maybe it was an earthquake, and you got people trapped in the rubble, and they're crying out, or you can see a hand or an arm sticking out, maybe waving, trying to get somebody's attention. And that's the image here of Job. He's left behind the tornado imagery. You know, he's trapped in this rubble of a home that's fallen apart, and he's crying out. He's got his hand stretched out. In other words, he's in this situation. He's crying out to God for help. He says, Did not I weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? So when I wasn't trapped there, I was also emotionally attached to people who needed my help. So with all that in mind, now listen to this, verse 26. But when I hoped for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came. Man, that's the worst.
Yeah.
You know, you're waiting for, let's say you've had a long, hard night. Insomnia. You can't sleep. Maybe it's nightmares. Maybe you're just worried. Maybe you're worried about yourself or your kids. Maybe you're sick. I mean, whatever it is has kept you up all night. And what's keeping you going is that you know eventually the night will end and the day will dawn. Well, just imagine, as ludicrous as it sounds, being in that position, and it rolls around, it's, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's still pitch black outside. And then it's 8, and then it's 9, and it's still pitch black outside. The sun does not rise. You hoped. You waited for light. And instead, you got more darkness. Yeah, that's Job's situation. Every day, he wakes up thinking, maybe things will be better now, and they're not. And well, what about the next day? And it's not. It's just this ongoing disappointment when he's done everything that he can think of to get God's attention and to hope and pray that he would bring some relief. So, verse 27, my inward parts are in turmoil and never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. I go about darkened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches.
We need to bring that. We need to bring that. Whatever that is, we need to bring that back.
That's
companion of ostriches. I don't know what that means, but
our minds think alike. I was thinking, man, that needs to be like a catchphrase. When things are going bad in your life, you can be like, dude, I just feel like I'm a companion of ostriches. So that's Job. My skin turns black and falls from me. I'm assuming this is literal, talking about his skin. My bones burn with heat. My lyre, that's the instrument, L-Y-R-E. My lyre is turned to mourning. Almost wish you could drop the R, tuned to mourning, right?
He's
just playing a dirge. My lyre is turned to mourning, and my pipe to the voice of those who weep.
Oh, so he can only sing sad songs right now. That's what
only
he's
sing sad songs. Yeah, I mean it's kind of the like the psalm says, how can we? Our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." And the exiles say, "How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land?" You know, we're not going to pull out the guitar and be strumming some happy songs here, because our instruments are tuned only to the dirge, and they can only produce sounds of a lamentation. You know, listen to this, verse 28, the second part of that verse. If this is literal anyway, he says, I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. Makes me wonder if Job has not been also not just kind of sitting on the ash heap, but trying to be in groups. Maybe it's a city assembly or whatever it is, asking for help. I mean, you got to think about his financial situation, whatever's left. I mean, he had servants who survived. What's happened to all of that?
Yeah.
You know, maybe he's looking for some kind of community assistance and he's not getting it.
Well, you think of it. I mean, Job has put forward a life that says that he should have all kinds of equity built up with those around him, right? I mean, how can a guy that did the things and lived the life that Job states that he lived and things and did the things that he did, like, how is there no one to help this man?
Yeah.
You know, right. Like, yeah. It's like, I mean, it's horrible.
Were all these people that he did good for? Yeah. Yeah. You'd think, I mean, that's the way it usually works, right? If I came to you during a time and you were in great need, and then it turns out I'm in great need, of course you're going to be,
yeah,
not only like bound, but wanting to help me out.
Yeah.
That's the way this usually works. And poor Job is not in that situation. So desperate times. And you know, we're at the end of our 40 minutes here. And Job is almost at the end of his speeches. I mean, he's going to say a couple more things, but it's going to be quite a few chapters. He's got one more chapter to go. In fact, ESV has it titled Job's Final Appeal.
Yeah.
So we'll get to that next episode. But Job's long speeches are drawing to an end. The curtain's about to close for that.
All right. Well, we will get to that closing curtain next episode. Chad, I'll see you then.
See you then.